QED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's opening hour of Forum, with the nomination last night by President Bush of Judge John G. Roberts Jr. to the U.S. Supreme Court, we'll look at the record of the nominee and what the confirmation process is apt to look like, with a number of legal experts as well as political experts and the president of NAREL, the National Abortion Rights League. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Yesterday, President George W. Bush announced his selection of 50-year-old Federal Appeals Court Judge John G. Roberts Jr. as his nominee to replace Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Judge Roberts, who was appointed by President Bush to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in 2003, is President Bush's first nominee to the High Court and the first court nominee in 12 years. A Harvard lawyer, Judge Roberts spent many years arguing cases before the Supreme Court before being appointed to the Court of Appeals in June of 2003. And in this morning's opening hour of Forum, we discuss the nomination of Judge John G. Roberts. And let me tell you who is joining us. Actually, we're going to be joined later, I ought to mention, by Nancy Keenan, president of NAREL, Pro-Choice America, since this has become certainly a lightning rod issue with respect to choice. But we're going to have with us for the whole hour Doug Kimmick, who is chair and professor of constitutional law with Pepperdine University Law School. And Doug Kimmick, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Deborah Rohde, who is Ernest W. McFarland professor of law and directs the Stanford Center on the Ethics at Stanford University Law School, also author of Access to Justice, and welcome.
Thank you.
Herman Belts will be with us this hour as well. He's professor of constitutional history at the University of Maryland and joins us from Rockville, Maryland. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined for the first part of the hour by Larry O'Rourke, national political correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. And welcome, Larry O'Rourke.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Doug Kimmick, let me begin with you. This is certainly, as far as the president is concerned, a nominee that presumably is going to show judicial restraint and who won't legislate from the bench. He has somebody who fills that bill, as he put it?
Oh, I think he does. John Roberts is a very temperate man. By personality, he's a very welcoming and open personality who listens well and makes judgments based on the record and the facts before him, and has, Michael, a very restrained view of the judicial function, a view of the judicial bench that allows democracy to speak its voice and to only be contradicted by the court when matters of individual right guaranteed by the Constitution are at issue.
You mentioned being contradicted by the court. We ought to mention that this is a man who is only 50 years old, which is certainly young by these standards and means a long time potentially on the court. And we're hearing already about the lack of a paper trail, although he did serve 2 years, has served 2 years, I should say, on the D.C. court. Of the close to 40 opinions, only three drew dissent. And what are we to make of that?
Well, and we also know that he's argued 39 cases before the Supreme Court, which is most than most people ever have an opportunity to argue in a lifetime, that he's been Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and White House counsel. I was privileged to work with him in both the Reagan and the Bush administrations. And so while, of course, he was advocating the positions of Presidents Reagan and the first President Bush in those circumstances, the Senate will be able to tell a good deal about his thinking and his approach to the law, not only from his cases on the D.C. Circuit, but also this lifetime of very high achievement, which is respected by hundreds of lawyers in Washington, D.C., of all political ideologies.
Doug Kimmick, again, is chair and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University Law School. Deborah Rohde is Ernest W. McFarland professor of law and directs the Stanford Center on Ethics at Stanford University Law School. And Deborah, this lack of a paper trail certainly is of great concern to those who are advocates for reproductive rights for women, particularly because, as Solicitor General, some of the statements he made about Roe versus Wade. But I just heard Jesse Chopra say, well, that's the job of a Solicitor General. He's supposed to be an advocate.
Well, it's hard to know from the filings he made in those cases, one brief of which argued directly that Roe was wrongly decided and should be overturned, whether he shares that political view or that was the government's position, which he was bound to advocate. I think it is of enormous concern for especially those who care about women's rights and civil rights, that this is someone who does indeed have a very distinguished legal background and is by all accounts a highly decent individual, but also one who would probably push the ballast of the court in a far-right direction. He's certainly been a member of conservative Republican groups. His public service has all been for conservative Republican organizations, and most of the people who are willing to speak on the record say privately that he's very conservative on these issues. So it's just hard to know from what we do know how he would decide some of the most fundamental issues of personal rights and liberties if he were to be confirmed.
But if I'm reading you correctly, you're suggesting that because of being identified with the Republican partisanship as strongly as he has been, this is going to be a swing vote, and it's probably going to be a swing vote to the right.
Yeah, I think there's very little doubt about that. That's why it is such a popular choice among the base of Bush's party.
But I'm also wondering about statements that he did make with respect to Roe, and we'll talk about this later with the head of NARAL. I mean, he made a personal statement when he was approved by for the D.C. court, for the circuit court, the federal court that he's on now. And I'll give a quote. It's the court's conclusion in Roe that there is a fundamental right to abortion finds no support in the text. Excuse me, that's what he said when he was arguing as Solicitor General. But when he was going through the confirmation process, he said, Roe versus Wade is the law of the land. There's nothing in my personal views that would prevent one from fully and faithfully applying that precedent.
Well, that was what he was saying for appointment as an appellate court judge. But as a Supreme Court judge, the job description is different. He's bound as an appellate court judge to apply settled principles, and at that point Roe was well and still is settled, but the Supreme Court is always free to reopen its judgment, and we can't tell from what he said then whether he has foreclosed that possibility, and it's certainly a legitimate subject for inquiry during the confirmation hearings.
Well, Larry O'Rourke has been sort of on the scene there. He is national political correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers and joins us from the nation's capital. Larry, how's this being viewed? I mean, particularly in light of the fact that he did go through that, he pretty much sailed through the confirmation process in the appeals court.
Well, I think it has to, the viewing has to be analyzed on two levels. Perhaps most importantly, from the Senate level, there has sort of been a muted response so far from, frankly, both sides. While some Republicans have been very much out front in endorsing the candidate, most of them have been saying, "Let's wait and see. Let's have these hearings. Let's let the process work, and then we'll make a judgment." The Democrats, interestingly, have been, by and large, saying the same thing. Senator Leahy, the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, the chairman of the committee, have used virtually the same language in terms of saying we'll have a thorough investigation, and then we'll have a hearing process that will not be bound by time, but will be bound by the scope, whatever it takes to conduct a thoughtful and a complete inquiry. So I think the Democrats, particularly, are the key players in this. They don't know at this point how they're going to proceed. Taking a filibuster, conducting a filibuster against Judge Roberts would be have any reasonable chance of success, whether it would be politically counterproductive. They clearly are under mounting pressure right from the outset from their own constituent groups to do that. But would that be so negative in the view of the country at this point that it would damage them individually and the Democratic Party collectively for a long time? So I think.
Well, excuse me. Didn't Senator Lieberman say it's not going to happen?
No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that. He was quoted by some of the Republicans as saying that. But when I talked to his office last night, his press secretary said that quote by Senator Lieberman had been misinterpreted and that he did not make that statement. And he did put out a formal statement, which I read carefully last night. And there is no mention by Senator Lieberman in the statement that there will not be a filibuster.
What about the fact that Senator Spector was called in by the president? I mean, he chairs the Judiciary Committee. One would presume that the president probably, as a member of, Senator Spector being a member of his party, said, look, I want this to be done expeditiously, and I want to make it happen. And one has to wonder about the kind of pressure on that score.
Well, just going back just a few weeks to the Gang of 14, part of the deal that they struck, which preserved the right of filibuster and ended the immediate threat of nuclear option, called on the president to consult, and the president immediately, through spokesmen at the White House, said that there would be consultation. And then not only Senator Spector, but Senator Leahy was contacted. Senators Frist and Reid were both contacted. So there was a certain modicum of consultation.
When Senators Leahy and Schirmer spoke to the press, though, yesterday, I got the sense and wanted to see if you did as well that Senator Schirmer was saying, hey, I voted against them, and now everything's up for grabs.
Well, what Senator Schumer said was, I voted against him, and that means voted against him in committee the last time around, 2-3 years ago, when he went through his confirmation process for the circuit court. As I also remember, essentially it was either a voice vote or an uncontested vote on the floor. What Schumer seemed to be saying was very interesting in analogy to the hearing for Alberto Gonzalez to be Attorney General. When that nomination was held up, as indeed the Bolton nomination has been held up, because the administration has refused to produce a certain amount of the paper you were previously talking about, there may not be much of a paper trail at this point, but we don't know how much paper there is that has not surfaced. And the Democrats, through Schumer anyway, well, strike that Schumer, perhaps speaking for the Democrats, said he was going to pretty aggressively pursue that paper trail.
Larry O'Rourke, national political correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, with us this morning from Washington, D.C. And also with us is Herman Belz, who's professor of constitutional history at the University of Maryland. He joins us from Rockland, Maryland. And I don't know, Professor Belz, if you saw this morning's New York Times editorial, but they put a good deal of emphasis on federalism and the Republican Party perhaps wanting states' rights and said that that ought to really be under close scrutiny. Just get like your comment on that, particularly because there was one case only that they alluded to, and that was an endangered species case, I guess, that they suggested might be really a way to measure the paper trail.
Well, I think the federalism concern has been a concern of Chief Justice Rehnquist. It's been a concern during his tenure off and on. There was an attempt to promote a more vital kind of federalism, and they've been changing it slightly. I don't think the New York Times is going to be the best place to think about what the court will be doing or what it ought to be doing. I do think federalism is an issue of importance, and there's a lot of ways to go about dealing with federalism. The main way that the Rehnquist court has tried to move in the direction of federalism is to give them a little more protection to states, and that they can do more things. The other side of federalism is to really cut back on national powers, cut back on the scope of the federal government. And that's a constitutional construction that depends more upon Congress and the executive than it does upon the courts. It's for them to take the initiative in that, and whether they will be doing that remains to be seen. The president's in a wartime situation, and he's trying to change the Social Security system. This means construction of national powers, and that's the main focus of federalism.
There's going to be, by most people's lights, a battle royal in this confirmation process. There's certainly going to be a lot of money spent and a lot of time and effort on both sides. I'd like to get, as a constitutional historian, I'd like to get your overview of just how much really one can press a potential nominee or a potential member of the Supreme Court in terms of personal views, in terms of litmus tests.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I'd say that the I'll put it this way. There's, the Democrats and the left, maybe not all Democrats, but a lot of Democrats and the left are preparing to do battle. And I think they will not call off the battle, even though it may be more difficult to find a long paper trail to try to nail Roberts, Judge Roberts, leading us into the question of personal opinions. Roberts said he didn't have any personal views that would get in the way of his recognizing Roe against Wade as the law of the land. Well, that might mean that when decisions are established and that he's not going to personally take up the cudgels and go around the law or try to subvert it to try to bring it down in a kind of radical breakthrough. The idea that Schumer said, Senator Schumer says, it's a whole new game at Supreme Court level is not true. It's not true. It's not true at all. And historically, it's not true that the Supreme Court doesn't make things up as it goes along. It ought not to. And when it looks like it is doing that, eventually that kind of thing slows down and gets stopped, if not reversed. But I'd say that the question for the Democrats historically is whether they want to go by what is now referred to as the Bork-Thomas template of hearings. That means to pull out all the stops, use vilifying language, and just try to trash the opposition. And I don't think they're going to do that with Judge Roberts.
Well, it's a lot harder when you got a guy who appears very civil and...
That's right. So that puts some limit, perhaps, on the going to the personal dimension of the thing to which you referred. And they will. I don't think they're going to try to dig up... they're always going to try to dig up dirt somewhere in there. But they may try to string it out and ask for his draft opinions and ask for documentation, and that seems like not the best. That may be they have to do some of that because I don't think they're going to be able to hit him with a 2x4 and make him cower.
Herman Belts again is with us from Rockville, Maryland, University of Maryland, professor of constitutional history. Doug Kamik, this is going to be a battle royal, I think, but President Bush wants to see actually things in place by the convening of the court, October 3rd. Your sense is that that's going to happen, probably? On track?
My sense is it is going to happen, and I don't think it's going to be a battle royal. I think there will be people who will, with extreme voices, who will try and make political points, but I think they will largely be unsuccessful. And Mike, my barometer on that is Senator Feinstein, who I heard this morning indicating that she found John Roberts to be well within the mainstream of legal thought, admiring of his academic achievements as well as his splendid reputation in Washington, D.C. as perhaps the smartest lawyer in America that appears before the Supreme Court in advocacy. Now, in fairness to Senator Feinstein, she wasn't prejudging the matter. She said, of course, that hearings needed to be conducted, and things are always discovered sometimes in the context of hearings. I'm confident that John Roberts will come through that process very well. One of the questions she did ask is one that you put to Professor Belts, and that is it's a question dealing with John Roberts' assessment of the scope of federal and state power. John, on that score, is very traditional. He observes the language of the Constitution, which gives Congress plenary authority over interstate commerce, but does reserve to the states its own police power to address questions of health and safety. And John, more than others, has been quite careful in trying to both observe state sovereignty and federal prerogative. And I think he'll be able to explain himself well to Senator Feinstein and the other members of the committee on that score.
Well, Deborah Rohde, when you have accolades from Senator Feinstein, and not only that, but the D.C. bar, including members of the Clinton administration, urged the first nomination, the one that died in the Senate both times, of John Roberts. Does that suggest to you that there will still be a very strong fight over confirmation?
Well, I think there'll be a fight. Certainly, he's going to be a hard nominee to oppose. No one doubts his intellectual ability, his capacities as a lawyer, and his political astuteness and personal qualities. He obviously has judicial temperament, and everyone seems to think he's going to do very well during the confirmation hearings, and he will have the support, certainly, of a bipartisan group. He has a lot of friends in Washington. I think the question really will be is the stakes in this at this historical moment are very high. Roe hangs by one vote, and I think it will legitimately be an issue whether he's prepared to recognize women's fundamental right to choose, and if there's any indication that he's not, whether that would place him out of the mainstream of judicial and public opinion in this nation. I think that will probably be the test. And this is someone who one would doubt has left a paper trail with many smoking guns. He's a very careful lawyer, judicious one. It would be surprising to find him expressing personal views in some of the papers that or draft opinions that individuals are bound to seek. So I think it's going to be hard to find a smoking gun, and I think it's going to be hard to muster the votes necessary to oppose somebody who clearly has as many of the qualifications that you want in a Supreme Court justice as he does.
And Larry O'Rourke, this is being viewed, I presume, as a pretty smart political move by President Bush and the President administration, despite the fact that he didn't name a woman or a Hispanic?
Well, it certainly is at this point. And, of course, making that analysis all the more easy, if not facile, is the fact that the belief here is that the president will have an additional opportunity to nominate someone to the Supreme Court within the reasonable future. And there are those who say, well, that perhaps that will be when he will even more aggressively tilt the court to the right. But, of course, I say that a little bit with a tongue-in-cheek because virtually every reporter here, including myself, we were geared up for the retirement announcement of the Chief Justice 10 days or a week ago, and all were compiling dossiers on the potential successors, and then the Chief Justice very neatly made it clear that he at that point had no intention of stepping down. So to some extent, we're all working in a vacuum, and the political community is equally engaged more in speculation than in fact at this point.
Well, we're coming up on a break. I want to extend thanks to Larry O'Rourke, who is leaving us, but I'm grateful for the time you spent with us, Larry. Larry O'Rourke, again, is national political correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers and joined us from the nation's capital. You can join us. In fact, if you have questions or comments, we're going to continue our discussion with the three professors who are with us. We're also going to be talking later on during the hour with Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. But if you'd like to join us with questions or comments, we invite you to do so. In fact, cordially invite you to do so. You can do that now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you wherever you're listening to us or however, on the radio, the Internet, or the Sirius satellite. You can join us now at 866-733-6786 as we discuss the White House nomination of Supreme Court Justice to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, John Roberts. Or you can also join us by email, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing the White House nomination to the Supreme Court of John Glover Roberts to replace Sandra Day O'Connor by the Bush administration, talking with Doug Kamik, who is chair and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine, and Deborah Rohde, Ernest W. McFarland professor of law and director of Stanford's Center on Ethics at Stanford, also the author of Access to Justice, and Herman Belz, who is professor of constitutional law at University of Maryland. You can join us if you have questions about the nominee or about the process, the confirmation process, or really about the issues that are coming up and will come up before the Supreme Court. We welcome your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us at our email address, which is forum@kqed.org. And before I start taking your calls and emails, I wanted to go again to Herman Belz, who is professor of constitutional history at University of Maryland. And an important issue, certainly I suppose as anybody who's gone through law school must realize, is the whole question of stare decisis. That's the Latin phrase, let the decision stand, which was the whole issue is the whole issue of case law. You read the case and then argue legal precedent when it comes up to appeal. We've got Justices Scalia and Thomas who don't seem nearly as committed to this. So should it come up? Ought it to come up with Congress? And what do you think we're going to hear?
Well, I think we're going to probably have some references to precedent when we talk about Roe against Wade in 1992, in the Casey decision, the majority decision was appealed to precedent. But as a matter of fact, in American constitutionalism, precedent does not have the force, doesn't have the weight, doesn't have the controlling influence that precedent or custom or tradition, all things that are analogous and related, it doesn't have the weight that those things would have in the British Constitution or in a different constitutional system. Our Constitution is written; it's based on first principles. Those principles are written into the Constitution, and the Constitution is not set in stone, and neither are decisions of the Supreme Court set in stone. As a matter of fact, the liberal image of this kind of constitution has always been, in the last 100 years or more, that of a living constitution, which changes with the culture, with the society. And the attempt to appeal to precedent in American constitutional law is a stretch. It's a strained effort to say that the Constitution changes permanently as a result of particular decisions, and Roe against Wade being a landmark liberal radical decision that has to be maintained. It's even been said on this interview that it hangs by one vote. I would say that Roe against Wade, as the Blackmun biography by Greenhouse shows, emerged in Blackmun's view out of the society and the culture. And the culture and the society may change with respect to the right of abortion, the unlimited right of abortion. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in appeals to precedent, and there may be some reference to it, but I think it's a weak argument.
Well, I'd like to hear, Deborah Rohde, what you have to say on that, because certainly conservatives say it's a faulty belief, because if you didn't overturn certain laws in the past, blacks would still be slaves and separate but equal would still be the law of the land.
Well, they're absolutely right, and you know, Plessy against Ferguson, the infamous separate but equal decision, was indeed a settled precedent for a very long period of time, and I think nobody wishes for a golden return to those days. But the question of abortion, I think, has provoked some leading judges, including some of those now serving on the Supreme Court, to say, well, irrespective of how I would have decided that case initially, now I view it as settled precedent. It's very hard to turn back the clock a quarter century and to take away an entitlement that the vast majority of Americans think belongs to women and is rooted in the Constitution. I mean, I think the polls really show an extraordinary level of consensus about leaving at least a basic right during the first trimester of abortion up to the woman, especially when her health, both physical and psychological, may be at issue. And to roll that decision back and send us into the years of backstreet abortions is, I think, fairly unthinkable. And I would imagine it would be possible for someone in Judge Roberts' position to say, you know, regardless of how I would have decided that case initially, at this point, you know, I do think there's value in adhering to precedent. And I could imagine having both a personal opposition to abortion and a willingness to respect the decision that the court has made and that has now become fairly well established under constitutional principles.
Well, since that is going to be, as we've clearly, I think, defined, one of the lightning rod issues in this confirmation, I wanted to go to Nancy Keenan, who is president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, joining us from Washington. Morning, Nancy.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing okay, and glad to have you here. We're talking about this whole confirmation process, and there is, let me put it out to you like this. There would be the argument that since Judge Roberts was Solicitor General and did what Solicitor Generals are supposed to be, that is, was an advocate, that his words against Roe really don't necessarily hold up as much as the things he said in his own confirmation process, which were that his personal views would not necessarily interfere in any way with Roe. So where are we going with this from Nehru's point of view?
Yeah, look, he was a top political appointment, a top political lawyer under the first Bush administration, and that administration trusted him. They trusted him to write the brief that basically held that he said that he believed that Roe was wrongly decided and should be overruled. The second Bush now, with this nomination, I mean, he also trusts him to carry out the plan, and I believe the plan is to erode and ultimately overturn Roe v. Wade.
But it could be like Justice Souter. I mean, you could be maybe second-guessing this and find out that you have a justice who acts in a very different way, couldn't you?
Well, it causes us pause here when the entire right-wing organization of this country is jumping for joy this morning. When you have folks that, for example, Operation Rescue, keep in mind that that was also something that he wrote with regard to the domestic gag rule. And here are folks that harass, intimidate, block women from accessing health care clinics, and ultimately resort to violence. And there again, he basically ruled in favor of them. You know, I have no doubt in my mind that this is a stealth candidate, that he shares the kind of right-wing ideology, that this is not about reason, this is about ideology, and he's low profile for a reason, and that is to fool the American public that this is a moderate. He is not a moderate.
Can you defeat this nomination at this point? Do you think it's realistic, especially since, as we've said during this hour, this appears to be a very civil, temperate man and certainly has support even of, well, a good deal of nonpartisan support?
Well, he's
bipartisan support, I should say. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. I'm having trouble here. Too many interviews. Could you ask that question again? I apologize.
No, I just wonder if somebody might argue, for example, that NARAL and organizations that are opposed to this nomination might be spinning wheels and spending a lot of money that could go to other causes because this nomination looks like it's headed toward being approved, particularly since this is a likable candidate, by all appearances a temperate candidate, and one who has bipartisan support.
You know, 65% of the American public says they don't want Roe v. Wade overturned. And I think that the Senate has to listen to that. And they have to, Americans will be calling their senators, talking to them, and telling them that, look, this should not just be immediately that because the president nominated him, it's just a go. We have to ask the questions where he stands on privacy and personal freedom. We expect him to answer those questions. And quite honestly, we're going to make sure that those questions are asked.
Well, when he was asked the question in the last confirmation hearing, when he was approved to be the judge that he is now, he said, there's nothing in my personal views that would prevent me from fully and faithfully applying that precedent, meaning Roe versus Wade.
I think that's true. But again, keep in mind that the right wing are saying this is perfect, and they are trying to convince the American public he's a moderate. Don't worry. The exact people who want to overturn Roe v. Wade are the same ones that are saying to the American public, don't worry, be happy, he won't do that. That causes us grave concerns. It causes us pause. And again, I do not think that he is a moderate candidate. I do not think that he will uphold Roe, our personal freedom, and or our privacy.
Actually, Nancy, I hate to take issue with you, but I don't know that anybody's painting this guy as a moderate. Everybody's saying he's 100% rock-solid conservative.
Well, conservative is one thing. I think there are many conservative. This is a right-wing nominee. This is not just a conservative. And the American public had said to this president, and he didn't listen. They said, we want somebody in the mold of a Justice Day O'Connor. This is a guy in the mold of Scalia and Thomas, and they are no more moderate than I can fly. And that's the issue here. He is to the far, far right.
Nancy Keenan, again, is president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Thank you for joining us, and take care of your voice, will you?
Yeah, thank you. It's been a long day.
Appreciate your being with us. Bye. Before we go to your calls, Doug Kamek, let me hear from you on this.
Well, I think Nancy Keenan has a political agenda that she's supporting and is passionate about it, and one can respect her point of view. I think John Roberts' point of view on this question is that the Constitution allows state legislatures and the Congress a reasonable degree of latitude to legislate on these subjects, and that when restrictions on partial birth abortion or restrictions on clinical practices or restrictions that relate to parental notice or consent, things of that nature come before him. He will take each of those cases as they arise in light of the latitude that is given to these regulatory bodies to address those topics. I don't think it's an all-or-nothing proposition. And in saying that, John Roberts is very likely, Professor Rohde put it well, that when he made his statements in the confirmation proceeding before, it was an appellate post that he was seeking, and that the Supreme Court is a different matter. But conservatives, including John Roberts, especially John Roberts, have a deep respect for precedent. But the way that the Supreme Court always puts it is that it is not an inexorable command, because you have to leave open the possibility that you've made mistakes in the past or you've overstated something and that people have misunderstood the ruling that you've made. I think the question of abortion is one that largely needs to rest with the people of the United States in their separate legislatures. I think that's where John Roberts as a judge will leave it. I don't think he'll impose his personal perspective from the bench, from the top down.
Doug Kamik again is chair and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University Law School. We're going to go right to your calls now, and let's
Hello.
Begin with Ed. Morning, Ed.
Hi. I'm critical. I'm of the work the Supreme Court has done in the last couple of years, particularly last year on the Michigan University affirmative action cases. They took two cases so they could decide one affirmative and one against, each time by like, I think it was a 6-3 and then a 5-4. Then this year, they took the two Ten Commandments cases, so then they decided one for and one against, and in each case, the Supreme Court is not doing work that provides guidance. Their explanations are inconsistent from one to the next, and their job is to be setting precedent clearly to be clarity for lower courts and for the legislature. And in these particular cases, as many others, they've done very badly.
I wonder about, let me go to Professor Belz with that. These split decisions, would you agree with Ed that they show perhaps some indecisiveness on the court's part?
Well, it would appear so, but the point would be that the purpose of the court's purpose is not to set precedents, to apply the Constitution in cases where it's not
case by case, right?
And interpret the Constitution, yeah. Case by case, fact by fact situations. That's right. And this appointment should be pleasing in the sense that it's intended to establish more clear-cut understanding of the Constitution, a correct understanding, a sound understanding of the Constitution, in the light of the original principles of the founding, the text of the Constitution, the course of constitutional law, and not to make radical changes as was made in adopting Roe against Wade in that decision in 1973. This is a temporary thing. The idea that also related here is the idea that the court has a certain kind of nice adjustment of balance to ideologies right now. And so it's just a kind of a moral imperative almost, if not a constitutional one, to replace Justice O'Connor with the nearest kind of thinker that Justice O'Connor is. That's weak. That's not persuasive. And the Roberts appointment is going to be a good one, and it's going to move the court off this ambivalence and ambiguity that besets it now. And that's to be appreciated.
We'll get to more of your calls. And Larry, you're up next. Good morning.
Hi. My point is, these guys are not some kind of intellectuals. They are political animals. That's how they get on the court. They get there because they have political connections. Roberts, he's a right winger, and anybody on the left who thinks that this guy is going to be moderate is fooling themselves. Bush, they have a plan to take control and maintain control of this country. Roberts is part of that plan. He's going to get on the court, and he's going to do things that is going to disturb a lot of people, not just on the left, but in the middle, because they have an agenda, and the Supreme Court is part of that long-term agenda. The guy's 50 years old. He's going to be on the court for probably 30 or 35 years. And anybody that thinks that intellectualism is going to play out here is just fooling themselves.
Well, let me go to the heart of thank you, Larry, for your comments. And Professor Rohde, I'd like to hear from you on this. This is, after all, a nominee who clerked for Justice Rehnquist, who was associate counsel to President Reagan and President Bush the First, a close friend of Kenneth Starr. I mean, certainly in terms of conservative credentials, they're all there. But how ought that really to make the nominee appear, particularly where the legislature is concerned?
Well, I think it's hard to oppose someone just on the basis of political ideology, especially in the context of this historical moment where clearly presidents have long wanted to make that shared judicial philosophy a prominent criterion in their selection of someone. And, you know, there's some real costs if you make the confirmation process turn on either issues of personal identity, you know, what is the person from a particular background or a particular racial group, or political partisanship. Yet by the same token, when someone is so far out of the mainstream, as, for example, Bork was, then I think you're going to see consensus build around forcing the president to make a more judicious appointment of someone who will be, at such a pivotal role in the decisions that affect every American's lives. And, you know, the president was absolutely correct in the way he opened his announcement last night that there are a few things that one can do in that office that are more important than making a selection for a justice, especially one who's likely to have at least a quarter of a century of service on the Supreme Court, if recent demographics are any guide.
Looking at some of your emails here, Alexis writes, maybe the issue of Roe versus Wade is being used as a red herring, because if Roberts passes the test, then he's in and free to have his way in all other realms of the law and for quite a long time. David writes, in a country that's so divided on key issues, how can the Supreme Court appointment process work if there are litmus tests for nominees? Shouldn't a balanced judgment on personal qualities, fairness, respect for the law, careful listening, and reasoning prevail? And Steve says, I believe a valid critique of this current nominee is his relative short time in the appellate court system. This will always look like a political appointment when the nominee spends more time defending political stances in the courts versus being a practicing judge. And one of our listeners who calls herself Granny says James Dobson, head of conservative and anti-choice group Focus on the Family, is very pleased by Roberts' nomination. While we don't know much about Roberts, his friends scare the hell out of me. I want to go to more of your calls, but just about the record, Doug Kamik, here's another listener who emails us and asks, didn't Roberts oppose clean air rules and work to help coal companies strip mine mountaintops?
No. What John Roberts did as an advocate in the Bush administration as Deputy Solicitor General was to argue that if you were bringing a case to the federal court, you have to observe the rules provided in Article 3 of the Constitution. You have to have a real case or controversy. You have to have a real stake in the matter. You can't just be a generally interested party. If everybody who was generally interested in a subject could file a lawsuit, we would be even in far worse shape than we are today. You have to have a economic or personal interest that is at risk, where someone is causing that harm or damage, and where the court has the ability to remedy it. And here's where John Roberts fits the profile that the president wanted all along, somebody who understands the limitations that we ourselves as a people have articulated for the courts, that they're not general problem solvers. We are the general problem solvers in the legislative assemblies. And in the courts, by contrast, are third parties who have a very important but discrete role to resolve grievances when people are concretely affected by specific facts, and John Roberts understands that.
And Doug Kamik is Chair and Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine, and Deborah Rohde is Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law at Stanford. Deborah, another question raised in an email from a listener named Sarah says, Roberts represented Toyota against an injured worker in a case that significantly weakened the Americans with Disabilities Act. Can you shed some light on that?
No, I don't think that you can draw much from that decision. It was a relatively technical decision. Is this the one where he's the Fourth Amendment challenge to someone who was detained for eating French fries on a metro train? Is that the case
the
individual
case,
is talking about?
Yeah.
That's a kind of fact-specific pattern that doesn't, I think, tell you too much. It was a unanimous decision about how he'd rule on more common and fundamental questions.
Do we know if this nominee tried to keep Congress from defending the Voting Rights Act, as another listener alleges?
Well, he certainly, in his position in as a deputy solicitor general, signed off on a number of interpretations of law that would have restricted its rights. But again, it's hard to generalize from those what his personal views are.
Let me go to more of your calls. And Pierre joins us next. Morning, Pierre.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a very, very quick point. My thoughts is that, fortunately, this person has very little judicial experience. He has been appellate judge only for 2 years, and before that he hasn't been anywhere near a bench, except to argue cases. That doesn't really allow people to judge how he would rule on certain important topics.
Professor Belts, what about inexperience as a criterion for a nominee?
Well, let's see. Do you need to be a judge? Well, that increasingly is going to be made into an issue, as long as it might have some kind of ideological traction. But the idea here in constitutional history, in constitutional law, in constitutional construction and interpretation, is that the Constitution is the fundamental political law of the nation. And there are political rights in the Constitution. And Hamilton in Federalist Number 78 says the judiciary is the least dangerous branch to the political rights of the Constitution. Now, what kind of experience prepares one for that? Not necessarily the experience of being a judge in all kinds of district or circuit court judge in all kinds of technical legal matters, but rather a broader understanding of the nature of the kind of government established by the Constitution and the political character of the regime, the political character of our people, as a constitutional democracy. Now, used to be a time when political men could serve, most of them were lawyers, but they were not judges. There were political senators, governors were appointed. And now we've increasingly narrowed our focus in who we think is worthy of being placed on the high court. And so 2 years judicial experience, all that litigation experience as a lawyer, no, I don't think it amounts to any kind of grave deficiency. And it's not a good idea to go down that line where you have to have a certain number of years on a court.
That's Herman Belts again, professor of constitutional history at the University of Maryland, with us this morning from Rockville, Maryland. And with us from Cotati is Stephen. Morning, Stephen.
Hi. In response to NARAL, Americans are in favor of a woman's right to choose, but certainly they're against partial birth abortion to the tune of about 78%. That was the area where Kerry came off to Americans as, for lack of a better term, either a blatant, he had to lie on his position on that. But going forward, so what if Roe v. Wade is overturned? That remark by NARAL that women will have to return to back alley abortions is pathetic. It's ridiculous. Of course, a good portion of the states will still have legal abortion, including the one that we're all sitting in California. And people really want an abortion that bad, all they'll have to do is go to a state where it's legal.
comment, Deborah Rohde.
Well, would that it were that easy. I mean, we know from the days before Roe was decided that that thousands of women died as a result of complications because they couldn't afford to get to a place where it was legal. And I think it would really minimize the importance of that issue to suggest that it's simply not important what the Supreme Court does on this question. And it has enormous symbolic as well as practical effects. You're taking away women's fundamental right to control the terms of their lives in a way that most Americans really would oppose. So I think it's a legitimate issue. I don't think that it's plausible to argue that this is someone who's unqualified simply because he's had 2 years on the bench. He's had more judicial experience than many people we've appointed to the bench, some of whom have come directly from political jobs or from the legal academy. And here's somebody who's argued over 30 cases before the Supreme Court, and there's no question about his command of constitutional jurisprudence. So I think qualifications is a non-starter.
On that note, we come to the conclusion of this hour, which has been certainly a very illuminating hour. I want to extend thanks to all of our guests. We spoke earlier with Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL, and with Larry O'Rourke, national political correspondent from McClatchy Newspapers. I want to thank those who were with us, three professors with us for the whole hour, Herman Belz, professor of constitutional history at University of Maryland, Deborah Rohde, Ernest W. McFarland, professor of law at Stanford University Law School and director of Stanford Center on Ethics, and Doug Kamik, who is chair of the Pepperdine University, chair and professor, of constitutional law at Pepperdine University Law School. And thanks to all of you, our listeners, our callers, our emailers. Another hour forum is coming your way, and we shift gears dramatically. We're going to talk about theater in the hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.